if we're honest, we will look into the mirror and see what the truth is, and see what the truth is, and see what the truth is.
Welcome to the No Illusions podcast. My name is Cameron Riley. This is number 45, recorded 27th of February 2012. First regular, just talking about shit in the news show that I've done since last year, really. Now that I got that whole South Africa Zimbabwe thing out of the working queue. Sitting at my desk at the Podomo Lounge in Brisbane, Australia, smoking a Podomo Reserve 10th Anniversary Maduro and drinking a Oettinger Pils out of the Podomo fridge. First thing I want to talk about today, I read this yesterday, kind of blew my mind really. There's a guy called Lawrence O'Donnell. If there are any Americans listening to this, you may be familiar with Lawrence O'Donnell. Personally, I'd never heard of him. He looks like an older version of Doogie Howser, Neil Patrick Harris, but apparently not related, which is how I ended up looking up this guy in the first place. I saw him on a TV show, Homeland, we were watching, and I went, this guy looks like Doogie Howser. Anyway, it says in Wikipedia, he's a progressive political analyst, journalist, actor, producer, writer, and host of The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell, a weeknight MSNBC opinion and news program. He was one of the producers and writers of West Wing, a great show. Anyway, the point is, under political views, here's what it has to say in Wikipedia, and I found this fascinating for an American media pundit. O'Donnell calls himself a practical European socialist. On a November 2010 Morning Joe show, he stated, "I'm not a progressive. I'm not a liberal who's so afraid of the word that I had to change my name to progressive. Liberals amuse me. I am a socialist. I lie to the extreme left of you mere liberals." He went on to say, the reason what he means by calling himself a socialist is not that we choose the socialist option every time, but we do consider socialism a reasonable option under certain circumstances. In fact, under many circumstances. As any introductory economics course can tell you, there is no capitalist economy anywhere in the world, and there is no socialist economy anywhere in the world, not even Cuba. We are all mixed economies, that is, mixes of capitalism and socialism, and we all vary that mix in different ways. China has more capitalism and a lot more capitalism than has Cuba, but it also has a lot more socialism than we, the United States, do. Our socialist programs include the biggest government spending programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, as well as welfare, and the socialist program I hate the most, agriculture subsidies. Yes, I'm a socialist, but I hate bad socialism, and there is plenty of bad socialism out there, just like there is plenty of bad capitalism out there, like the capitalism that pollutes our rivers or makes healthcare too expensive for so many people. I can argue this because every side of this is true. Capitalism is good, capitalism is bad. Socialism is good, socialism is bad. All of these things are true at the same time. That's why we have a mixed economy. An economy in which we are trying to use the best, most efficient forms of capitalism and the best, most efficient forms of socialism where necessary. So my full truth is I am as much a capitalist as I am a socialist. But since we live in the only mature country in the world where socialist is considered such a dirty word that no one would dare admit to being one, I feel more compelled to stand up for the socialist side of me than the capitalist side of me. I like that quote. I think it accurately describes my position on things. I think there are some good things in capitalism and some bad things in capitalism. And the same is obviously true of socialism. Although I would say that in most developed countries of the world right now, capitalism is running amok. There is so much wealth consolidated into the hands of so few that is enabling them to have way too much political power and control over the media, which in turn controls how people think or what people know about what's going on in the world. They also have way too much control of the legal and justice system because they can afford more lawyers and better lawyers than anyone else can, and they can tie up anyone they like in court, from individuals through to other businesses who are challenging them in terms of competition. And that stops innovation, it stops justice, it stops us progressing as a society. So anyway, Lawrence O'Donnell there, worth keeping an eye on him. Let's turn now to some recent writings by friend of the show, I'll call him that even though he's only been a guest once, Mr. Noam Chomsky, or Professor Noam Chomsky, I should say. Noam wrote something recently for Tom's Dispatch, which was also carried in Al Jazeera, talking about the current state of American policy, global policy. And he has some interesting things to say about Iran. Now, the whole build-up about, American build-up threatening intervention in the case of Iran has been taking on a fairly concerning tone over the last 6 months. And here's what Chomsky has to say in this quite lengthy article. I'll just pull out a couple of salient paragraphs. It says, in the United States, before the massive propaganda campaigns of the past few years, the majority of the population agreed with most of the world that, as a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Iran has a right to carry out uranium enrichment. And even today, a large majority favors peaceful means for dealing with Iran. There is even strong opposition to military engagement if Iran and Israel are at war. Only a quarter regard Iran as an important concern for the US altogether. But it is not unusual for there to be a gap, often a chasm, dividing public opinion and policy. Why exactly is Iran regarded as such a colossal threat? The question is rarely discussed, but it is not hard to find a serious answer, though not, as usual, in the fevered pronouncements. The most authoritative answer is provided by the Pentagon and the intelligence services in their regular reports to Congress on global security. They report that Iran does not pose a military threat. Its military spending is very low, even by the standards of the region, minuscule, of course, in comparison with the US. Iran has little capacity to deploy force. Its strategic doctrines are defensive, designed to deter invasion long enough for diplomacy to set it. If Iran is developing nuclear weapons capability, they report, that would be part of its deterrence strategy. No serious analyst believes that the ruling clerics are eager to see their country and possessions vaporized, the immediate consequence of their coming even close to initiating a nuclear war. And it is hardly necessary to spell out the reasons why an Iranian leadership would be concerned with deterrence under existing circumstances. The regime is doubtless a serious threat to much of its own population, and regrettably is hardly unique on that score. But the primary threat to the US and Israel is that Iran might deter their free exercise of violence. A further threat is that the Iranians clearly seek to extend their influence to neighbouring Iraq and Afghanistan and beyond as well. Those illegitimate acts are called destabilizing, or worse. In contrast, forceful imposition of US influence halfway around the world contributes to stability and order in accord with traditional doctrine about who owns the world. It makes very good sense to try to prevent Iran from joining the nuclear weapons states, including the three that have refused to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Israel, India, and Pakistan, all of which have been assisted in developing nuclear weapons by the US and are still being assisted by them. It is not impossible to approach that goal by peaceful diplomatic means. One approach, which enjoys overwhelming international support, is to undertake meaningful steps towards establishing a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East, including Iran and Israel, and applying as well to US forces deployed there, better still, extending to South Asia. Support for such efforts is so strong that the Obama administration has been compelled to formally agree, but with reservations. Crucially, that Israel's nuclear program must not be placed under the auspices of the International Atomic Energy Association, and that no state, meaning the US, should be required to release information about Israeli nuclear facilities and activities, including information pertaining to previous nuclear transfers to Israel. Obama also accepts Israel's position that any such proposal must be conditional on a comprehensive peace settlement, which the US and Israel can continue to delay indefinitely. So worth keeping those words of wisdom in mind from Mr. Chomsky, Professor Chomsky, again, I should say, when you're reading the ramp up and the rhetoric around Israel in the coming months or years. Probably by now you might have heard about the latest murmurings from the faster-than-light neutrino experiments that came out a few months ago. For those of you who don't recall, there were some scientists, or haven't heard the story, there were some researchers at CERN in Switzerland that back about 5 or 6 months ago claimed that they'd done an experiment that demonstrated that neutrinos had travelled faster than the speed of light. Now, neutrinos are the lightest particles that we're aware of. And, of course, those of you without a background in physics, according to our Einsteinian view of physics, which has held solid for nearly a century, actually for a century now, it's 2012, nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. Basically, E equals mc squared means that the faster that something travels, the more mass that it takes on, and the more energy is required to move it, and it would be impossible to move it faster than the speed of light. You would need more energy than is capable of pushing something with that mass forwards. So this caused a big uproar 5 or 6 months ago, and there was some, you know, in the media was going nuts about it, and you know, a lot of the world's physicists came forward at the time and said, "Well, look, this is certainly interesting, but we would, we would need to see some experiments." I need to take a drink. We would need to see the experiments. We need to be able to verify it, duplicate it, replicate it, etc. And there were some issues that came out with the experiment. So there's some things that were picked up early on. So they tried it again, and they fixed that, and they still got the same result. Came out though late last week that they've discovered another problem with the original experiments. I'm going to read from Ars Technica. "Science Insider is reporting that there was a good reason the measurements and reality weren't lining up. A loose fiber optic cable was causing one of the atomic clocks used to time the neutrino's flight to produce spurious results. If the report is confirmed, right now there's only one source, then it provides a simple explanation for the fascinating yet difficult to accept results. According to the new report, researchers are preparing to gather new data with the clocks properly hooked into computers, which should definitively indicate whether the loose connection was at fault." Then there was another statement that came out from the researchers indicate they found two potential issues. One of them was the optical cabling. And the two issues would be resolved, and they would have to do new measurements. So fascinating that you know, some of the best, most respected physicists in the world did this experiment not once but twice, and managed to have a loose cable connecting to the clock, which skewed the results. But here's the great thing about science. You know, when they came out with this result, it wasn't unanimously accepted. You know, the scientific process requires rigorous checking, documenting the experiment, the ability to replicate the experiment, see if different scientists get the same results. So, you know, this is why science is the most effective methodology that we've come up with yet at this point, to try and get as close as we possibly can with our tiny primate brains to figuring out what's likely to be true about how the universe works and why it's here versus subjective opinion. So I tip my hat to the scientific community in this case. I look forward to the results of the new experiments when they plug in their clock properly to see what happens, because really, if they can demonstrate repeatedly that neutrinos can travel faster than the speed of light, it's going to turn physics as we know it on its head, and that's a very exciting thing. Staying on science stories, this one came out in the last week or so. From the Sydney Morning Herald, nanotransistor breakthrough to offer billion times faster computer. Sydney scientists have built the world's tiniest transistor by precisely positioning a single phosphorus atom in a silicon crystal. The nano device is an important step in the development of quantum computers, super powerful devices that will use weird quantum properties of atoms to perform calculations billions of times faster than today's computers. Michelle Simmons of the University of New South Wales said single-atom devices had only been made before by chance, and their margin of error for placement of the atom was about 10 nanometers, which affected performance. Her team was the first to be able to manipulate individual atoms with exquisite precision. Using a technique involving a scanning tunneling microscope, they were able to replace one silicon atom from a group of six with one phosphorus atom, achieving a placement accuracy of better than half a nanometer. The device is perfect, Professor Simmons, director of the Australian Centre of Excellence for Quantum Computation and Communication Technology, said. The single atom sits between two pairs of electrodes, one about 20 nanometers apart, the other about 100 nanometers apart. When voltages were applied across the electrodes, the nano device worked like a transistor, a device that can amplify and switch electronic signals. The research was published in the journal Nature Nanotechnology. There's been predictions for quite a few years now that for Moore's Law to continue, Moore's Law, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, says that the number of transistors that you can squeeze onto a computer circuit board double about every 2 years. This has been true since the 50s. And we're starting to get to some technical hurdles as these things get smaller and smaller. And, there have been predictions that we would need to get down to the single atom level by 2020. Well, they decided to beat that level. So it's here we are, 2012. They've got a single atom. But obviously, they say 15 to 20 years of research before quantum computers become widely available. But this is a massive thing. I mean, for those of you that have listened to the podcasts I've done on the singularity with guys like Ray Kurzweil, you know that we're looking into a future of 10, 15, 20 years from now where computers are billions of times more powerful than they are today. You know, you start to think about the future that we're heading into and what that's going to open up in terms of new frontiers for the human race if we survive that long. This is a very exciting time to be alive. You know, we are standing on the frontier of changes to life that are so profound that they're going to fundamentally change what it means to be a human being. In fact, human beings may change so dramatically in the next 20 or 30 years as a result of quantum computing, artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, and genetics that we may not even recognize human beings 30 years from now. We may have completely evolved beyond our current comprehension. We're talking about things like massive life extension, if not immortality. We're talking about having access to computers that are almost gods in terms of their ability to compute, but also to be able to create new things from molecular blueprints using nanofabricators. It's an amazing, exciting time to be alive, folks. So keep an eye on Professor Michelle Simmons, good Aussie, and this Australian Centre of Excellence for Quantum Computation and Communication Technology. I'm going to set a Google alert against her name, and I'll bring you any new news that comes out from her team. This is my last story for the show today, and it's a story I've been talking to a lot of people about over the last week since I read it. Absolutely blows my mind, and I must admit I don't fully understand it. That's not new. I don't understand most of the things I talk about on this show, but I'm trying to understand it, but it blows my mind. This is a story that I read in Wired magazine called "The Forgetting Pill Erases Painful Memories Forever." And I'll cut to some of the key sections here. It says the chemistry of the brain is in constant flux, with the typical neural protein lasting anywhere from 2 weeks to a few months before it breaks down and gets reabsorbed. How then do some of our memories seem to last forever? It's as if they are sturdier than the mind itself. Scientists have narrowed down the list of molecules that seem essential to the creation of long-term memory. Sea slugs and mice, without these compounds, are total amnesiacs. But until recently, nobody knew how they worked. In the 1980s, a Columbia University neurologist named Todd Sackdoor became obsessed with this mental mystery. His breakthrough came from an unlikely source. My dad was a biochemist, Sackdoor says. He was the one who said I should look into this molecule because it seems to have some neat properties. Sackdoor's father had suggested a molecule called protein kinase C, an enzyme turned on by surges of calcium ions in the brain. This enzyme seemed to have a bunch of properties necessary to be a regulator of long-term potentiation, Sackdoor says. But so did a bunch of other molecules. It took me a few years to figure out if my dad was right. In fact, it took Sackdoor more than a decade. He spent 3 years just trying to purify the molecule. What he discovered is that a form of protein kinase C called PKM-zeta hangs around the synapses, the junctions where the neurons connect, for an unusually long time. And without it, stable recollections start to disappear. While scientists like Nader had erased memories using chemicals that inhibited all protein synthesis, Sackdoor was the first to target a single memory protein so specifically. The trick was finding a chemical that inhibited PKM-zeta activity. It turned out to be remarkably easy, Sackdoor says. All we had to do was order this inhibitor compound from the chemical catalogue and then give it to the animals. You could watch them forget. What does PKM-zeta do? The molecule's crucial trick is that it increases the density of a particular type of sensor called an AMPA receptor on the outside of a neuron. It's an ion channel, a gateway to the interior of a cell that, when opened, makes it easier for adjacent cells to excite one another. While neurons are normally shy strangers struggling to interact, PKM-zeta turns them into intimate friends, happy to exchange all sorts of incidental information. This process requires constant upkeep. Every long-term memory is always on the verge of vanishing. As a result, even a brief interruption of PKM-zeta activity can dismantle the function of a steadfast circuit. So let me sort of break that down into understandable language and talk about what they did here. So they did these experiments with rats where they taught them to associate a buzzer going off with an electric shock. So after they taught them, every time the buzzer went off, the rats froze in fear of this electric shock coming. Then what they would do is inject the rats with this inhibitor, and they would forget that they were supposed to expect a shock when the buzzer went off, and they would run around like nothing had happened. And then when the inhibitor wore off, they would still have forgotten that the buzzer was supposed to be associated with an electric shock. It basically broke the connection between the neurons that stored this memory permanently, so they didn't remember it again. Now, this is an absolutely fascinating concept for me. You know, we think of long-term memory as being something that's somehow hard etched into our brains and hard etched accurately as well. But what they're saying here is that our memories aren't hard etched as we think of them. Every time you remember something, basically the brain has to pull together that memory from different neurons in your brain. And then it will store that memory using this PKM-zeta. Using the protein that stores it. Let me scroll back up here and remember what the name of the protein is. PKM-zeta. That's right. PKM-zeta is the protein. So it will try and store that memory as best as it can, but if you lose that PKM-zeta, it has to try and pull together this memory again. So every time you remember something, your brain is actually cobbling together that memory afresh each time. It's going, okay, well, I take this neuron from here and this neuron from there, and I pull it together. And one of the things that they're talking about they might be able to do with these PKM-zeta inhibitors is turn it into a pill. And if you're suffering from some sort of post-traumatic stress disorder, if you were in the military, you went to Iraq and somebody blew up in front of you, and since then you've been having nightmares and you can't sleep, they would give you this pill, which would inhibit the PKM zeta, and then ask you to remember that event. You wouldn't be able to remember it because your brain wouldn't be able to pull together the right neurons. And then once the pill wore off, that memory would be gone, because the collection routine of those neurons will have disappeared from your brain. And so that memory would effectively be gone. It's quite fascinating, and it tells us a lot about how memory works and how accurate it is or isn't. We walk around thinking that we have this accurate translation of the world, but the more we learn about the brain and memory and our senses, the more we realize that our brain gives us a version of events, but it's not an accurate version of events, even as we experience things on a moment-to-moment basis, let alone the stuff that's stored in memory. So fascinating story. I look forward to hearing more about that. Speaking of illusions, I went to reach for it, but I realized I'm not on camera. My book that I published as an e-book just before Christmas, The Three Illusions, is now out on paperback. You can find a link to where to buy both the e-book and the paperback from on my website, threeillusions.com. And I've got the first copy of the paperback today. It's very exciting to get the first copy of your first book. So, I hope some of you have had a chance to read it. There's some interesting reviews of the book up on Amazon, and I'm glad that it's out there. All right, well, thanks for listening, folks. That's show number 45. Do I have anything else to tell you? No, that's it. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back soon. Cheers. The revolution will not be televised.